Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. And with me, as should hopefully always be with ATLS, is Mike Sharma. Mike, how are you doing?
I'm awesome, Chip. Thanks for bringing me on today.
Yeah, so we are now actually going to the first chapter of ATLS, which is, I believe, like the initial assessment and management side, right?
That's correct. Yeah, this is a really broad and intimidating chapter to go over, but we're going to dive in, and it's a good appetizer for the rest of the book.
Now, because of all of the details in this chapter, we talked about it, and we have decided that we're going to hit like more broad strokes to start with, because in the following chapters, we're going to go in more into detail on each one of these subjects. So don't feel like, hey, we didn't really talk much about it, because this is really meant to be fast-paced and moving and really sticking with the highlights here. One thing that we're going to do here to keep ourselves on track and focused, when you look at an ATLS book, they have red text. And the red texts are kind of like the highlights and the things that are most likely to show up in a test. So we're going to make sure to cover things that are in red. But we're also going to talk a little bit about things that we particularly like and think that is highly important, or things that may not be covered as much in other chapters. So we want to make sure to hit it harder here. So that's kind of what we're focusing on, rather than trying to hit every single part of chapter one.
Yeah, that would take a long time.
So let's get started with the most basic part. The primary and secondary surveys are repeated frequently to identify any change in the patient's status and indicates the need for additional intervention. But Mike, what is a primary and secondary survey?
Yeah, it's so important that you have a systematic approach to the trauma patient when you come up. And just like we've kind of been taught in other places, you do the exam of an organ system the same way every time. You do your trauma assessment the same way every time, because it's so easy to be distracted by, hey, that limb is missing, or he doesn't seem to be breathing very well. You've got to make sure you go in a systematic fashion so you are not missing critical parts that may not be so obvious at first glance.
And then your secondary survey is like a much deeper dive, because now you're going head to toe following what I think of in the EMS side is DCAT BTLS, which stands for deformities, contusions, abrasions, punctures, penetrations, burns, tenderness, laceration, swelling. That's a lot. So
that was amazing. I'm really impressed you did that.
Yeah. My EMS roots show strong here. But what that really means is that you're going through the entire process head to toe. So you're checking the head for all that. You're checking the face. You're checking the shoulders, the arms, the chest, the abdomen, the pelvis, the lower extremities. So you cover everything that way to make sure you catch all the things that you missed during your primary survey. Because again, your primary survey is to catch all the life-threatening stuff. And in some cases, depending on your environment, you may only do a primary survey ever. You may not actually ever get into the true secondary survey, and that's okay.
Right. And I think another important phrase that is needs to be pounded on here, repeated frequently. If this is a really seriously injured patient, this patient is going to be in flux. You might fix something, and on your secondary assessment, it's taken that long for another organ system to start to decompensate. And so that repeated frequently thing is super important. And if you ever get stuck on your practical portion of the test, or if you get stuck in life with a patient, what do I do now? It's never a bad thing to go back through your primary survey one more time to make sure everything you did is still holding firm.
Especially when patients start to decompensate unexpectedly. When that happens, that's a really great time to go back through your primary survey and figure out what's happened that you could have missed. All right, so I think enough about like talking about it. Let's actually kind of go a little more into detail of that process. But first, I think we need to talk a little bit about the preparation side, if you will, of like when we know a trauma patient's coming in.
Right. And something that I think does not get enough attention is that preparation phase. A lot of people have this mentality of, hey, I'm just going to rise to the occasion when the horrible thing happens. But I know that in Afghanistan, when we were receiving trauma patients, one thing we always did well before that patient hit the door was assigning roles. And I think that's a hugely important thing that is not emphasized enough. Before the patient even came through into our trauma bay, My one medic knew that he was going to be the IV IO access person. The other medic knew he was going to be the O2 person. I had two other medics that were going to be basically disrobing and checking for bleeds as needed. And it's so comforting to the team because trauma is messy and trauma is scary, and these patients could be literally dying on you. If your people know exactly what their first three or four steps to do are right when the patient comes in, number one, that's reassuring to them that they are not going to be stuck confused. They know their role immediately. Number two, if you are in the position of trauma team leader, which I did in Afghanistan, then that also makes your job easier. Your people are already doing what they know to do, and you can be focused on quality control instead of having to give a bunch of directions right up front. Those directions are already given before the patient comes in.
And this is really important too, because if everyone knows their role and starts acting right away, this saves critical time to focus on the things that are needed most. The one thing I would discuss, especially for us, because a lot of people who are listening to this are pre-hospital or hospital-based. That, you know, my audience tends to lean more towards the hospital side, but we definitely have a lot of pre-hospital people listening here. One of the most important things I feel that gets overlooked is the handoff process. And that occurs from pre-hospital to hospital and then from hospital to interfacility transfer, because that's something that drops a lot of times. That is a very dangerous thing to occur for a variety of reasons, but one of the biggest is missing something early on that could potentially be life-threatening. And if we know that from the beginning, that's a key point. As far as like how to actually do a great handoff, I've got some previous podcasts before that I'll link in the show notes to actually go over that more, because that's so broad of a topic. But the biggest thing is that I would talk about right now is just make sure to have a quick pause. And whether that's before you hand the patient over onto the stretcher, to the bed, or if you have it once the patient's on the bed, at some point there just needs to be about a 10 to 30 second pause and let the person who had that patient give the report to hand over the said patient.
I totally agree. A lot of us work in busy ERs, but I always make an effort to stop what I'm doing when the ambulance team comes in to receive that handoff. It's critical and it saves you time on the back end. After you've gotten that handoff, the next thing for you to do is that primary survey, your ABCDEs. We've all heard this. If you spent any time in medicine, you've heard about the ABCDEs and the different variations on that. What you're doing is very quickly in seconds for a lot of people, checking for airway, breathing, circulation, deformity, and exposing very quickly to address life threats. And as you find a life threat, you're stopping wherever you're at, A, B, C, D, E, and you are addressing that life threat immediately. Why is that important? Again, these are life threats. And so you can't just note that, hey, that patient isn't breathing. Make a mental note and move on to something else. No, you've got to start doing something about that. Whether it's, is this an oxygenation problem? Let's put an O2 mask on. Oh, no, it's a ventilation problem. Hey, you start BVMing this patient, or let's work to get ready to intubate. So addressing the life threats as they come along in your primary survey.
The one thing I would add about ABCDE that I really don't like is that it doesn't emphasize massive hemorrhage first. And when I'm talking about massive hemorrhage, I'm talking about like the blood volume of the patient is pouring out in front of you kind of thing. Not the little bleeders here or there are about worrying about hemodynamic stability in the sense of like a soft blood pressure. I'm talking about this patient is actively hemorrhaging to death in front of you. That kind of falls right at the beginning, but I don't feel like ATLS does as good a job about that. There's what's called the MARCH protocol, which does better because the M stands for massive hemorrhage, and then everything else kind of falls out into the ABCDE. But that's my big one there that I just want to add, is that keep in mind massive hemorrhage, even though it doesn't spell it out right there, should be the top of your list because that's what's most likely to kill that patient and the hardest thing to get back on track, especially when you don't have blood products right there.
I can't agree more, and I'm so looking forward to going over that when we get to C. We're going to wrap back around to that.
All right, so let's talk about airway maintenance. So the big thing here is that you will most likely need to establish a definitive airway if there's any doubt about the patient's ability to maintain that airway. Sometimes it's also a prognostic thing. So if you're looking ahead, and this is someone who may deteriorate in the time it takes to transfer that patient, or maybe someone who is going to need to go to surgery right away, and this is part of the process to get them ready to go. You want to make sure to ask the questions that you can first before you intubate this person, but you don't want to wait too long. It's easier to do a hemodynamic stable intubation than one where this person is under the hop killers. And the hop killers are hemodynamics, oxygenation, pH, and pH is for acidosis. If that person's hemodynamically unstable, if they have oxygenation issues, or if they have acidosis, which in trauma, they can have all three of these, you will kill your patient when you try to intubate them. So sometimes you don't have to put the airway in right that second, but you need to recognize that the airway is going to be an issue and get that patient primed so that you can do the safest intubation possible. And if there is any true concern about it, then you need to be careful about the cervical spine, especially when intubating, because traditionally with a lot of intubation maneuvers, we move the cervical spine a lot. So this is not one of those times to do that. You want to try and keep it as immobile as possible. And preferably, if you are going to have to intubate with someone with a C collar on, a hyperangulated blade can be very helpful there.
Right. So intubation is going to be key, and at least thinking about it. Maybe you don't do it right away. Sometimes you'll do certain things to just keep the airway patent. You might have oral or nasopharyngeal airways. But something else to think about is that if you start going towards the intubation direction, you're going to have that plan B. You want to have plan A and plan B. When we were in the military and doing trauma, as we were going to intubate people, we literally had someone, their job was basically to find the Crike kit, the cricothyrotomy kit, and put it on the patient's chest as we were attempting intubation, because it's a heck of a thing to do. Well, back then we were doing our rapid sequence intubation. It's a heck of a thing to sedate and paralyze someone, try to intubate, and you can't do it, then we're all looking around as far as what to do. When the cry kit's laying on the chest, it's very easy to know the right thing to do, and it makes it very easy to go ahead and do that in a timely fashion.
I will add one last thing to that that I really like. Baltimore Shock Trauma has this great protocol and about their airway attempts. And basically, you get up to, doesn't mean you have to use all three, but you get up to three attempts at endotracheal intubation for which you should be optimizing and doing something new and better to further optimize your attempt with each intubation attempt. And then if you're unsuccessful after three, statistically speaking, you are unlikely that you're going to get that intubation further down. So you need to move to a different type of airway. So basically a supraglottic airway. And if that is unsuccessful, you have reached what's called KYCO, can't intubate, can't oxygenate. And at that point, that's when your surgical airway should occur. But keep in mind, it can occur sooner than that. If you got someone with a horribly deformed face, or if you have someone with terrible burns where by the time you do your first attempt, you look and you see, hey, there's not anything and I can even stick a little soda straw through, then you need to go to that surgical airway.
So that's A, airway. The next thing is breathing and ventilation. Great. The airway is patent, but is there gas exchange going on? Is air going in and out? Something I want to highlight, one of our big killers in trauma is pneumothorax. So when you're looking at a patient and you're suspecting that someone's got a pneumothorax and you're concerned that, hey, there's a possible pneumothorax going on, and this person has a hard time breathing, chest decompression should follow immediately. And if you look in the manual, this is not in red. In my opinion, why is this not in red? Attention pneumothorax is something that kills and kills quickly. And if someone is already in extremis, they're already circling the drain, to be very blunt about it here. If you think that, hey, maybe the cause of this is a tension pneumothorax, let's go ahead and do that needle chest decompression, our needle thoracotomy, because guess what? They're about to die. And you sticking a 14-gauge needle into their chest wall, either in the front or kind of the anterior axillary line as what is being advocated recently here, you're not going to kill them any harder by doing that relatively minimally invasive procedure, minimally traumatic procedure, and you could end up saving their life or at least temporizing them until they can get a chest tube and more definitive. Again, we are trying to address life threats as they come along in our A, B, C, D, E, and tension pneumothorax sure as heck is one of those life threats.
I do want to add one thing. We're going to talk about this a lot more in detail when we get to that section, but you can also do a finger thoracostomy. I know it doesn't specifically bring it up in ATLS, at least in like the highlights portion, but a finger thoracostomy to me is a lot more definitive than the needle. And there's lots of different reasons why, and we'll talk about that more later. But just know that instead of using a needle, if you are trained and know how to do it, you should probably be doing a finger thoracostomy instead.
I like that. Yeah, just where we were at that time, the needle was the way to go, but I know people are really advocating for the finger in certain arenas now.
I give people the finger all the time.
As well you should.
All right, so circulation with hemorrhage control. So this is our C component. Mike, what can you tell us about this?
Oh my gosh. This is another, how is this not in red moment for me? It says it in the text. I'm just going to read it straight out. Hemorrhage is the predominant cause of preventable deaths after injury. So look, we've all heard this paradigm of there are three different kinds of patients out there. There are patients that no matter what you do to them, they will live. Despite your best efforts to kill them, they will still live. And there are other patients that no matter who is there and how close they are to a level one trauma center, no matter what assets you bring to bear on the patient, that patient will still die. The third group of patients that is so critical is that set of patients. And I think, frankly, they're relatively small, is that based on who is there and what skills they bring to bear at that moment in a timely fashion, that patient's life hangs in the balance. The preventable deaths. That's what we really care about. And hemorrhage is the predominant cause. I love what Chip said about how exsanguinating, massive exsanguinating hemorrhage should be something you look at very early on before you get to A and B, because it's very easy to put oxygen back into somebody. It's a lot harder to put blood back into somebody. And there's going to be plenty of time to go over tourniquets and my love affair with tourniquets, but tourniquets have a lot less risk than I think people who are inexperienced with them think. And if we can throw a tourniquet on very quickly and clamp down on some exsanguinated hemorrhage here, you are, again, going to save a lot of time in the back end and save a lot of morbidity and mortality with this patient.
Couldn't agree with you more. And junctional bleeds are a bitch because we're going to talk about that more separately. But that's basically like axilla, groin, and neck, because when those bleed, you can't necessarily throw a tourniquet on those. And that becomes a much bigger challenge. But those are also some of the ones that are highest rate of lethality because it's harder to control hemorrhage at those points.
Yeah, that was really an art form back when I was doing trauma, is how to apply that pressure just so to get it up into the axilla and the groin. It was real tricky. I feel like they still haven't cracked the code perfectly on like commercial devices that do that, but it's definitely something to think about. And there's different adjuncts that I'm sure we're going to get to later on that can be good in those non-compressible areas.
And then one last thing, because like I said, we're going to dive a whole lot more into each one of these sections down the line, is that aggressive and continued volume resuscitation is not a substitute for definitive control of hemorrhage. So while you can dump blood products in this person all day, this is something that eventually they need to go to wherever their location is to get treated. We want to make sure that that massive transfusion protocol that we're going to need to work up to in some cases, we do that early, and we make sure that when that patient is transferred, whether it's transferred to the OR or transferred to a different facility so they can receive the care that they need, that that person has blood products in tow, because this gets delayed, just like getting the initial round of blood products can be very delayed.
Something I think it's very important for your test and important for life is calling surgery or calling for a transfer early in those patients where you recognize, like, oh boy, this person has hemorrhage that I cannot definitively control. I need to get them quickly in front of someone who can. And so that's going to be a point you'll be tested on during your practicals. And also when you're really dealing with patients, you need to be able to recognize that point early and recognize when you're at your limits and need to tap out and call the surgeon or get the transfer process, which as we know, can take a long, long time with a sick patient in front of you. Get that rolling soon.
All right, let's move on to disability here. So the easiest way to think about this is like GCS. So this is your neurological evaluation. And with GCS, remember it's 6-5-4. So you have a 6-cylinder engine that's a motor. I like this because this is actually, I think, what Mike did. So 6-cylinder engine motor, that's your motor part. 5, we'll think of V for verbal. So like the Roman numeral V. So there's 5 components for verbal. And then if you call someone 4 eyes, well, that's eyes. So there's 4 components to that. And that's an easy way to remember your 6-5-4, who gets what number based on what part of the exam.
Yeah, I totally cribbed that from the SGEM, and I bet Ken Milne stole that from somewhere else as well. So I take credit for it, but Ken, thank you for that. And thanks for over to taught Ken that as well.
Now, another thing is that patients with evidence of brain injury should be treated at a facility that has the personnel and resources to anticipate and manage the needs of these patients. When resources to care for these patients are not available, arrangements for transfer should begin as soon as this condition is recognized. And what I take away from this point is something that I'm doing all the time. So if a patient comes in where they are head trauma, if we have the CT readily available, that patient's going to go over there as soon as we secure an airway, and we're going to scan them. And the main reason why we're scanning them is because brain CT is relatively cheap, if you will. Like the radiation is not as much as going to be for other parts of the body. It's non-contrast. You don't have to worry about that. And it can give you a whole lot of information to then share with your tertiary care facility that you transfer them to. And another part of the reason why, like, we tend, at least locally with where I've done trauma, whether it's in the critical access, community level, or even, you know, kind of secondary care centers, you know, not the full tertiary, we tend to get the head CT earlier on because if there's a bleed, great, we know exactly where we're going with this. If there's not, then we need to kind of consider, are there other factors to play like drugs or alcohol that is complicating our picture here? But we do that. If the CT of the head is positive, then we're done. We're not worrying about a CAT scan of anything else. We may do a FAST exam. If it's me there, I'm going to do an eFAST exam. But we have recognized that this is someone who no longer is going to be managed locally, and they're going to have to be transferred no matter what. So let's not delay the transfer any longer than we absolutely have to.
Yeah, I agree. If you can make it to where the transfer team is rolling into your bay right as you're doing your last packaging motions here, that is like, it's like conducting an orchestra, you know, just like everything kind of coming together and there being harmony here. And so, yeah, early calls for transfer, early getting that direction going is critical. And again, we're talking about, you know, time is money, time is morbidity, time is mortality with these patients. And we need to get that transfer thing going quickly.
All right, so what can you tell us about exposure and environmental control, the E?
Yeah, I feel like E is kind of like the forgotten about stepchild of the A, B, C, D, E 5-pointed star. You know, when we were doing trauma in the military, hypothermia was one of the things we talked about in our lethal triad. For us, we were getting patients that were, you know, driven to us or flown to us. We were exposing them, treating the trauma, and then getting them back into a helicopter. Well, look, that helicopter is flying at several thousand feet in the air and flying very quickly. The patient's already lost a fair amount of blood. We may have put non-warmed fluids into that patient. And so now their core temperature is dropping. That core temperature dropping can lead to acidosis. And that is one of those things that will kill the patient that's not so obvious that you want to try to control and get ahead of early instead of trying to correct. We were in Afghanistan. It was hot, as they say, as balls in Afghanistan. And so we love to like get our air conditioning going, and we love to get as much of our uniform off as we could, because it was hot taking care of these patients. But we quickly realized, hey, wait a second, we can't do this. If we cool the trauma bay, we're cooling the patient. And so we have to kind of take the hit as the trauma team and be a little uncomfortable for the good of the patient here. I kind of hit on fluid warmers, and there's different kinds of devices out there, and also some good data behind which devices work better or worse for warming fluids. A neat kind of a trick here, if you are out in the hinterlands and you don't quite have all these fancy, fancy devices here, a microwave can be used to warm crystalloids. I wouldn't use it to warm blood products, but crystalloid fluids, if you're going to do a quick bolus of crystalloids here, those can be warmed up in the old microwave right after you get done moving the hot pockets out of there.
But please, 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 if you have blood products and if you can avoid it all, try not to get the pasta water.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That's kind of the joke that a lot of traumatologists call salt water. It's pasta water, right? Great for cooking pasta, not good for resuscitating patients.
And we're going to talk about that a whole lot more in a whole separate section, but it's just something that if you are only listening to this and something comes across, just try not to give much crystalloids. Like, really try and only give blood products. And that's a bit of a controversial point, but we'll tie back later why that's so important. All right, moving to the adjuncts to the primary survey with resuscitation. So, like, physiologic parameters such as pulse rate, blood pressure, pulse pressure, ventilatory rate, ABG levels, body temperature, and urinary output are accessible measures that reflect the adequacy of resuscitation. And the values of the parameters should be obtained as soon as practical during or after the primary survey and reevaluated periodically.
Yeah, you know, these are all kind of substitutes for what's really going on. We get pulse pressure and blood pressure as kind of some objective way we can measure perfusion. In the end, these can be manipulated. These things can be swayed either way, left or right. And so these are adjuncts, but they're just substitutes for what's really going on in the body, but can be good vital signs, as they say, to get us thinking that, hey, maybe this patient is decompensating on the inside. Another thing, too, is this. When you're in the hospital, you have almost an unlimited amount of things you can do. We've said it already. We'll say it again. It is important not to delay transfer to perform an in-depth diagnostic evaluation. You're going to do your ABCDEs first, make some decisions, make some initial life-saving adjuncts right there. And then as far as testing goes, you know, we're basically, if you already know the patient needs to be transferred, hold off on those extra tests. Hold off on suturing that little laceration on someone's arm if you've got that bleeding controlled. Someone else at the definitive care can handle those things. This is a packaging process. We're kind of getting this patient stable and wrapping them up so we can put them in the mail and get them to where they need to go to be unwrapped and definitively treated.
Moving on to special populations, and we are wrapping up with this here. So we're going to hit the big highlights, like the things mostly in red that are kind of some of the big things to know about, and then we'll be done for this round, which is kind of nice. I think we're staying relatively on track this time in a good way. Priorities for the care of these patients are the same as for all patients, but these individuals may have physiologic responses that do not follow expected patterns and anatomic differences that require special equipment or consideration.
Right, so who are we talking about here? We're talking about kids. We're talking about pregnant patients, the elderly, people on certain medications or with certain medical conditions. Sometimes those conditions can fool you as far as what's going on. Sometimes people can hang in there very well until they crump. And so sometimes, you know, you've got to get ahead of these patients before they maybe hit the end of that abundant physiological reserve, as they say. You know, they do so well until all of a sudden they're not doing so well. And so you want to recognize these certain populations who can't hang in there, maybe the young, the young and healthy children, and just know that even though they're hanging in there right now, we've got to assess which direction they're going.
And as far as like the secondary survey, because this is kind of where you're going to start doing more of your secondary survey, I think that's something that's broad enough we'll have to talk more about separately. But some of the key highlights, because we'll go into it more in different sections, is like with head lacerations, scalp wounds can bleed a lot. And that's one of those exsanguinating hemorrhages that we have to keep in mind that it can be very tricky and sudden that you don't think about because this person is just constantly bleeding from the scalp and they're being transferred and moved around. So you know, you really don't think about the blood the same way. But if you got like a really bad scalp wound, staple it, like staple it early, control it early. And then if you have someone that you're worried about edema, and edema can kind of show up quickly, like do an early eye exam. It can be really basic. You just need to make sure that there are no obvious things you have to be concerned about. And then when it comes to the neck, patients with maxillofacial or head trauma should be presumed to have a C-spine injury unless you can otherwise rule it out, because fracture and ligamentous injuries can be easy to miss. And while C-spine CT is great, it may not be enough. Sometimes these people need MRIs to actually be able to fully evaluate it. So restrict the cervical spine early and often, and then you can always back down as you need to.
Yeah, there's some great clinical tools like the Nexus criteria or the Canadian C-spine rules. The Canadian rules are a little more cumbersome in a way. You might need some sort of an app or just be really on the ball memorizing the criteria there. But those are known, I think, to be just a little more sensitive than the Nexus criteria. And so, but you want to have some sort of reason as far as, hey, I don't need to use a C-spine restriction in a person who has this maxillofacial or head trauma.
Personally, I almost always use the Canadian CT head and C-spine rules, and that's because of how well validated it is. Nexus is not a bad alternative to use, but once you get used to it, if you just start using clinically on every single patient, appropriate, of course, like your 16 to 65 range with the Canadian rules, you'll find out how easy it is to memorize, and you will start picking up, oh yeah, this patient falls into this category. Given most of your patients in extremis or the ones who are bad trauma, they automatically qualify. So that is a no-brainer. But the people who come in with like the focal head injury or the post-car accident, and they come in 2 hours later because they start having neck pain, like I love the Canadian C-spine rule for them.
Yeah, I think I need to bite the bullet and be more comfortable with that. And it'll probably come to me with time and repeated use like you're suggesting.
All right, so moving on to a couple other things here. The vaginal exam should be performed in patients who are only at risk for vaginal injury, just like doing the rectal exams has been kind of moved away from as well. Protection of the spinal cord is required at all times until a spinal injury has been excluded. An early consultation with a neurosurgeon or orthopedic surgeon is necessary if a spinal injury is detected. That's not just talking about the C spine, but we're also talking about the T spine or L spine. And given a lot of these may not actually be that bad, some of them they may not think much about it, but you want to at least talk to them because these are very tricky ones and sometimes require some special imaging, which may require the transfer anyway, like a lot of places may not have readily accessible MRI. And trauma patients must be reevaluated constantly to ensure that there are no new findings that are overlooked, because things can change over time. Things can present later than what was initially expected.
I think these last two things really are, if we're going to go over like, what do you take away from chapter one? The two big things you take away from chapter one that aren't necessarily going to be covered again in more detail later on is, when you find something that necessitates transfer, transfer. Get transfer rolling quickly. You identified now a couple of them. Some sort of a surgical complication, some sort of a neurosurgical complication, and now some sort of a spinal injury. These are three big decision points at which you want to say, hey, we figured something out that we don't have the resources to deal with at our location. And so start talking to your secretary or admin team and getting the transfer process rolling. The second one wraps back to, I think, the first point we talked about, is that reevaluate A, B, C, D, E, and then reevaluate. Because something that is also in Reddit in this textbook, it says that the secondary survey does not begin until A, B, C, D, E is completed and we're seeing some improvement, meaning that, okay, hey, we identified a problem with airway or circulation. We address those things as we came across them. We get to the end of A, B, C, D, E, and hey, look at that. The patient's oxygen saturation is going up. Or look at that. The dressing we put on that bleeding extremity is not soaked through with blood. Our treatments, our interventions are working. Now that we know that these things are working, we can move on. If they're not working, we need to reevaluate what we just did and recognize, hey, maybe that airway device we put in we thought was keeping the airway patent, maybe it's not as patent as we thought it was. That bleeding control device we put on, maybe I didn't tie it tight enough or apply it in the right way. So reevaluation is super important, and tapping out when you recognize that this patient needs something you don't have is super important, and things you will be tested on during your practical exam and also in life.
Something that is really important to me personally that drives me crazy when I see this in reality, and something that I think is worth just hammering home here for a second, is that you need to treat people's pain. Something that has blown my mind and is still seen time from time, and I try and correct it as quickly as possible, is when someone says like, oh, we can't treat the pain because hemodynamically, if we do that and we get them too relaxed, their blood pressure will bottom out. Like bullshit there for a second. Because if you're relying on their catecholamine surge to keep them alive, like you have a lot bigger issues you should be addressing. You should be treating the hemodynamics, not just holding off on the pain control side. Plus, there are some really great medications you can use that will be more hemodynamically stable. One of my favorites is ketamine, of course, but even like a dab of fentanyl can be something that can really help with pain and not cause the extremes in hypotension like you'll see with, say, hydromorphone or morphine. But if I'm really, really, really worried about it, they're going to get ketamine early on because that does have some catecholamine effects. But also, I'm recognizing that this person needs hemodynamic stability. And so what am I going to do? I'm going to give them blood products. I'm going to potentially give them pressors, which is a bit of a controversial issue. We'll have to talk about that more separately. But the key is that I'm giving them something so I can control their pain. I'm not going to trust and rely on someone screaming in agony and feeling miserable, because I know if I was in their situation, I would be less concerned about my hemodynamics and more concerned about my pain in that moment. And if you absolutely have to, like completely sedate that patient so everything else can occur. Because sometimes you get in that point where you have to just completely sedate them to be able to provide their care. But that should be like an extreme on the end. A lot of times, if you just treat their pain a little bit, it makes a huge difference.
I think there's an argument to be made that when someone is in extremes of pain, that's actually getting in the way of their care and getting in the way of you trying to reduce morbidity and mortality.
Absolutely. Sorry.
No, that's okay. There are negative effects to the catecholamine surge that the patient is undergoing. And also, if someone's still conscious, guess what? They may not just lie there and take it when they're in a lot of pain. A lot of emergency providers joke about 10 out of 10 pain and the pain scale. And when someone is sitting upright in a chair eating Cheetos and talking about how they're in 10 out of 10 pain, I've seen 10 out of 10 pain. I've seen people howling like animals and clawing feverishly at the tourniquet that's on their leg that is saving their life from preventing them from bleeding out from femoral wound because the pain is so extraordinary. And so, that's a time when, look, we need to control their pain and maybe even give an anxiolytic, maybe a benzodiazepine or some other anxiolytic, so that this patient is participating in their care, or at best, or at worst, rather, and not impeding our ability to provide care to this patient.
Absolutely. So we're wrapping up here. A couple of last things that we should talk about. Record keeping is crucial because you need to be able to document what happened at what times and what people got what meds then. And so that way you can know when it's maybe due for the next round, especially when you have someone who's intubated and sedated. You don't want to have gaps when they are now waking up from their sedation too prematurely, and also to understand doses and understand what's been seen. So that way, when the next person finds it, they know what's going on. All those things, everything, the more meticulous the record, the better the record keeping, the more you're going to help the next person who's going to take care of that patient. And then the other big thing that I want to talk about real quick is that after each one of these resuscitations, or after every trauma patient, because not all trauma patients are going to require resuscitation, but after every trauma patient, there should be some sort of after action review, or AAR. And this can be something that's really quick and dirty to start with, where maybe we don't have a lot of time to go into all the details, but you at least want to talk about the big things. You know, what do you feel? What were you thinking? You know, the big highlights and the hot offload that is talked about sometimes, which I also have in a previous podcast that I'll link to, is one way to kind of just go through that really quickly. And then later on, you can do the more in-depth after action review that's sometimes needed.
Boy, I can think back to when we first started taking care of trauma with our team. And I think about how our process evolved, both in record keeping. You know, we actually devised ways to keep better records and then transmit those records because we were basically putting our patients in a helicopter and they were going to another team at a different hospital. And I could not provide a direct communication with them. I had to communicate with the flight medic who would then communicate to the other team. And so some sort of written documentation was critical in that role. The after action review, the AAR, which is a time-honored military acronym as well, is so important because we are human beings and trauma can bring out a lot of emotions in us, whether it's during the trauma, emotion or confusion impedes our ability to take care of this patient. That's one way. But also, you know, when you are working elbow to elbow with people in a high stress environment, sometimes you can rub each other the wrong way. And sometimes there are things that need to be said at the end of the session instead of just diving into your next, you know, sore throat or stubbed toe or whatever else has come into the ER since then. If you're looking to have a trauma team that gets better, every time you do a trauma, you get better, which should be, I think, a goal. I think that with trauma and with medical care, you're either getting dumber or smarter every day. You're either getting better or less good when you're taking care of patients. It's very hard to stay perfectly at equilibrium here. This after action review is critical and is a way for people to get things off their chest, for people to talk through a case and identify ways that things can be better for next time and a way for that team cohesion also to build and to support the next trauma that rolls through the door.
All right, Mike. Well, I think we have kind of met our time here as far as like what we're able to go through. And gosh, there's so much more to talk about, but that's why we have these individual chapters to go into even more detail.
Yeah, we have like 12 chapters to go. This is going to be great. We're going to go real depth with all these things and make sure people can do great for ATLS and for great for taking care of their trauma patients later on.
All right, Mike, well, go ahead and give us the tagline. Let's end it.
I'm honored. Until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.